What comes to mind? What images pop in your imagination when I say the word Inquisition? Now, many people hear that and they shudder. They get maybe even a queasy feeling because of the way the Inquisition has been cast in novels and movies. And there's some truth in that portrayal, one-sided and stereotyped as it may be. We're backing up again in our timeline as we take a closer look at this sad chapter of church history to see how it propels us into the Reformation. The Fourth Lateran Council of 1215 was the high water mark of the medieval papacy under Pope Innocent III. The council, though, was little more than a rubber stamp committee for Innocent's reforms. Those brought much needed positive change to the morals of the clergy, but they also installed some structures that worked against later reforms. The Fourth Lateran Council established the doctrine of transubstantiation and the sacrament of penance. It also made official the Inquisition, which had begun as a commission of inquiry under Pope Alexander III about a generation before, but now, with the Fourth Lateran Council, it becomes a permanent feature. The major challenge that Innocent III faced was from the Albigensians, also known as the Cathars, inhabiting southern France. Now, we've already covered this supposed heretical group in an earlier episode, so I'm just going to say that if the reports by their opponents about them are true, they were a dualistic pseudo-Christian cult-turned movement that possessed a lot of energy during its relatively short life. Innocent sought to convert them first by preaching and debates, but early efforts met with little success. And so, frustrated, he approved a crusade against them in 1209. That crusade lasted about 20 years. It crushed the Albigensians, but only by devastating southern France in the process. It was the Albigensians that so provoked Dominic and propelled his efforts in launching the Dominicans. Though the Albigensian heresy was eventually put down, their earlier successes convinced the Pope that the Church would be better served if it had the means to conduct official investigations into questions of doctrine. Now, earlier popes had authorized bishops to investigate accused heretics in their area, and based just on rumor alone, it was up to the accused to prove their innocence. And that became the foundational premise for the Inquisition. Instead of the modern notion of innocent until proven guilty, the Inquisition operated by the principle that the accused was guilty until they proved their innocence. The assumption ran, hey, if there's nothing to be concerned about, where'd the accusation come from in the first place? Because as we all know, no one would ever accuse an innocent person of something just because they didn't like them. I mean, that never happens. The Inquisition was an ecclesiastical institution whose aim was to search out and punish heretics. The punishment for heresy was death, since it was regarded on par with treason and witchcraft, crimes that potentially imperiled the health and well-being of thousands. In 1199, Innocent III issued a decretal saying for the first time that heresy was treason under Roman law. A decretal is a papal letter. It's a ruling on some feature of canon or church law. In the 12th century, bishops turned confirmed heretics over to secular authorities for execution. But the Fourth Lateran Council confirmed these regulations and threatened excommunication of temporal civil rulers who failed to rid their territory of heresy and heretics. In 1229, the Synod of Toulouse drew up the procedures for seeking out and punishing heresy. The inquisitor was subject to no law outside the Pope's authority. He was the prosecutor and the judge. The trial was secret, with the accused having to prove their innocence, as in all courts following Roman law, without the benefit of counsel or the knowledge of their accusers. The final step in establishing the Inquisition came in 1252, when Pope Innocent IV authorized torture as a means of getting information and confessions from accused heretics. Till then, church leaders rejected with horror the very thought of torture. But no such reserve remained after Innocent III ascended the papal throne and the Catholic Church achieved its majestic and powerful unity. Noteworthy among the tortures used by the Inquisition is that while execution was still carried out by the civil government, it was priests who did the torturing by fire or stretching on the rack or beatings that allowed no bloodletting. Because remember, good Christians can't shed blood. Inquisitors developed effective methods for inflicting pain without blood. It was an ugly business. But following the musings of Augustine centuries before, Most agreed that saving the body by amputating a rotten limb was the path of wisdom. The church was the body, the heretic, the rotten limb. So chalk up yet another abhorrent idea that we can attribute to Augustine. Well, the Inquisition developed a complex system for classifying heresy and heretics. There were heretics who simply added beliefs to the essentials, and then there were those who denied the essentials. Those accused of heresy were categorized as lightly suspect, vehemently suspect, or violently suspect. Now, typically, the inquisitor would arrive in town, begin his work by preaching a sermon calling for people to bring forth charges against those they knew were guilty of something damnable, or maybe confessing something in themselves they feared was aberrant. The people were then given a period of grace to make this initial confession. This was called the General Inquisition. When that period expired, the Special Inquisition began, and the accused were summoned to trial. The inquisitor then functioned as prosecutor, judge, and jury. The trial was held in secret. The testimony of only two witnesses was enough to condemn someone. The accused most often wasn't even aware of the charges against them. They had no context for answering questions. The witnesses weren't named, and there was no defense attorney. Now, there might have been, except for the fact that any lawyer, any attorney who'd defend the accused was likely going to be brought up on charges themselves for defending error. Trials could last years with the accused kept in prison the entire time. Now, once torture was applied, it was kept on until a confession was secured. And all of that because the Inquisition followed very strict rules. And one of them was a prohibition of repeating torture. It could only be used once. So once torture was applied, it was with the understanding that the victim was either going to die or they were going to confess. Now, as I said, the Inquisition followed a strict set of rules, except when it didn't, which, as a rule, was often. Children, the elderly, and pregnant women were exempt from torture, except when they weren't. Those convicted of lighter charges who recanted their error were allowed to do penance, and they would bear the physical markers of their having fallen afoul of the Inquisition for the rest of their lives. We're talking about scars and psychological trauma. The worst of the heretics were hauled to the stake to be burned. Their lands and possessions were confiscated by the inquisitor who kept them, adding them to the church's treasury, or sold off. The heirs of heretics who'd lost lands were technically able to reclaim them, but were in reality rarely able to. Now, the Inquisition met with varying success around Europe. In Spain, it was co-opted by the crown. The Spanish Inquisition then became a thing of abject terror, what most people think of today when they hear the word Inquisition. The Spanish Inquisition was turned by bad actors to both religious and political ends, with the accused often being convicted more for the acquisition of their property than any real heresy. In Germany, the Inquisition was fierce under the zealous fanatic Conrad of Marburg, but when he was murdered, it fizzled out. France's inquisitorial campaign differed from north to south. In southern France, inquisitors continued to root out the Cathars, while in the north, trials were often a reflection of old feuds, with nobles accusing one another for political and economic ends. Italy, with its patchwork of provinces, saw spotty application of the Inquisition. In England, it hardly appeared. Now, modern Christians find it nearly impossible to understand the medieval attitude towards heresy. We regard faith as a matter of personal choice and seldom think of religious beliefs as a matter of life and death. Why would anyone die for their faith or kill another for theirs? Medieval European Christians would consider that modern view equally odd. You see, faith was most certainly not a private individual intellectual preserve. The Christian faith was the glue that united people. Denial of a single article of the faith was understood, well, it's a kind of treason because it imperiled one's neighbors. An apostate or heretic, if not punished by the authorities, well, that might result in God's wrath, manifest in drought, famine, plague, war. God might very well punish those who let heretics get away with their error. The heavy emphasis on the individual that is such a prominent feature of the modern Western world, that's very far from the collective community that dominated the thinking of medieval Europe. There was no such thing as a private faith. society was thought to be a manifestation of the Christian faith. The church was society's soul. Under such a worldview, heresy was a spiritual malady that imperiled everything. So the question follows, what is heresy? Well, in the 12th century, it was the denial of any doctrine of the Christian faith. But the list of what was considered inviolable doctrine was a bit different from what most Christians regard essentials today. The unity of the church and the divine appointment of the Pope as head of the church were part and parcel of the body of beliefs that Christians were to hold. Any variance from the beliefs of the official church was regarded as heresy. In dealing with heretics, the church had two objectives. First was the return of the heretic to a position of approved faith. And second was the protection of society, which in nearly everyone's mind was equivalent to Christianity. It was, they assumed, a thoroughly Christian society. The central question was, how far can the church go to protect the faith and the society that faith sustained? Is it right to take a life in order to protect other lives? Not just their physical lives, but their eternal souls? We won't understand the medieval world's posture towards heresy until we understand it in those terms. The church viewed itself as the moral and spiritual steward of European civilization. The challenge of heresy drove the Western Roman Church to its greatest internal conflict, the question of how the church could employ violence as a safeguard to orthodoxy and a peaceful society. And the tragic answer to that question was the Inquisition, a permanent blight on the church's reputation. The Inquisition demonstrates what happens when people substitute common sense, political expediency, and pure reason for biblical fidelity. On the surface, it's impossible to get from the crucified Christ who said, "Follow me," to the horrors of the Inquisition. Yet the prosecutors of the reign of terror known as the Inquisition saw themselves as nothing less than agents of Christ. The Inquisition not only executed heretics, it first subjected them to prolonged torture. And driving out one demon, the church opened the door for seven others. But the absurdity of the entire thing was not apparent at the time. Oh, sure, yeah, there were a few who were uncomfortable with what was being done in God's name, but they kept silent for fear of being the Inquisition's next victims. Most went along with the Inquisition because the pace for killing in the name of God had already been set by the Crusades. A church that sent crusading armies against infidels over there somewhere could certainly condemn and execute heretics right here. Everyone agreed a pure church was the will of God. The question was how to get there. While there were real threats to the doctrinal purity of the church, many of the attacks the church faced came from genuine believers who saw corruption in the clergy and wanted reform. It was easy for those church leaders being called out to use the power of their office to brand their critics as heretics and bring down the full weight of society on their sorry heads. Other critics didn't attack corrupt clergy so much as beliefs that diverged from Scripture. While these doctrinal challenges occasionally did see a realignment with God's Word, more often they were labeled as pernicious assaults by the forces of hell, and the challenger was summarily done away with. One of the earliest voices against the worldliness of the Roman Church was Arnold, the abbot of Brescia in northern Italy. In a series of sermons, Arnold said that the vices of the clergy were a result of the church's marriage to civil power. He urged the church to surrender its property and secular influence back to civil government and return to the poverty and simplicity of the early church. He said that the true church's mission was the gospel. In 1139, Arnold managed to raise enough support that he turned the people against their bishop. Pope Innocent II banished Arnold from Italy. He went to Paris, where he studied under Abelard, another thorn in the church's side. After 5 years in exile, Arnold returned to Rome and joined a movement to overthrow the Pope. The Romans, filled with dreams of the ancient Roman Republic, seized power during the Pope's absence, and Arnold became the leader of a new, purely secular government. He announced that the clergy should live in apostolic poverty and denounced the College of Cardinals as a den of thieves. Arnold and his group managed to retain power for 10 years before Pope Hadrian IV placed Rome under an interdict and persuaded Emperor Frederick Barbarossa to intervene. Arnold was captured and executed a year later in 1155 by being burnt. The final insult was having his ashes thrown into the Tiber River. People had barely forgotten Arnold when another voice for reform arose in eastern France. His name was Peter Waldo, a wealthy merchant in Lyon. One day, Waldo heard a wandering troubadour singing the virtues of the monastic life. The ballad was about a young Alexis whose wealthy Roman parents pressed him into an arranged marriage. But the reluctant groom was dedicated to the ideal of chastity, and so on his wedding night, he made a pact of virgin purity with his bride and immediately left for the Holy Land. Alexis' parents searched for him in vain. Years later, he returned home a beggar, so emaciated from his lifestyle of self-denial that no one recognized him. He lived in the courtyard on scraps from the family table. Only as he lay dying did he reveal his identity, too late for the grieving family to claim him. The moral of the ballad was clear to Waldo. A Christian must be willing to sacrifice everything in this life for the sake of the next. Struck to the heart by the story, he sought out a priest to find out how he could live like Christ. The priest turned him to the answer that Jesus gave to the rich young ruler in Matthew 19, verse 21, when he said, "If you would be perfect, go, sell what you possess and give to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven, and come, follow me." It was the same text that 9 centuries before had launched the monastic movement with Anthony in Egypt, the first of the Desert Fathers. Well, Waldo determined to follow the very same path. He provided an adequate income for his wife, placed his 2 daughters in a convent, and gave the rest of his estate to the poor. To launch his mission, Waldo enlisted a couple of priests to translate portions of the Bible into French. Then, after memorizing long passages, Waldo began teaching commoners how to imitate Christ by practicing voluntary poverty. His innovations lay in applying the life of poverty and discipleship to all believers, not just monks, as Francis of Assisi soon would. As followers joined his growing ranks, Waldo sent them out 2 by 2 after the apostolic pattern into villages and marketplaces to teach and explain the scriptures. They called themselves the poor in spirit. We know them as the Waldenses, named after their founder, Peter Waldo. But Waldo's unauthorized preaching soon met opposition by the Archbishop of Lyon, who ordered him to stop. Waldo refused, quoting Peter in Acts chapter 5, verse 29. He says, "We must obey God rather than men." The Archbishop excommunicated him. Now, did you catch that? I said that Peter's preaching was unauthorized. An odd concept to most churchgoers today, when anyone can preach anything, anytime, and anywhere. But not so in the medieval church. No, preaching was solely the domain of ordained priests and monks. Preaching was a right. It was conferred by the official church hierarchy on those who'd been properly trained. Unauthorized preaching was a violation of canon law and worthy of punishment. So Waldo and his followers appealed his excommunication to the Pope. They arrived in Rome to find it crowded with churchmen attending the Third Lateran Council of 1179. They were able to gain a hearing before the council, but had the misfortune of being ridiculed by a smooth, fast-talking Englishman named Walter Mapp. Pope Alexander III found no evidence of heresy among them. He was impressed by their poverty. They were mere laymen, however, and so he ruled that they could preach only at the invitation of bishops, which, of course, was unlikely. Peter Waldo was convinced that the scriptures commanded him to preach to the poor with or without church approval. Along with a growing bevy of followers, he continued to preach and practice apostolic poverty. The movement spread into southern France and across the Alps into Italy. By 1184, their disobedience compelled Pope Lucius III to excommunicate them in toto. The conflict is understandable. The Waldenses wanted to purify the church by a return to the simple life of the apostles. That meant surrendering worldly power. Their aim, like that of the Roman church, was salvation, but their means, well, they were radically different. The Pope couldn't renounce the church's right to give the sacraments. He couldn't forfeit the priesthood. He couldn't admit that faith in God might be something other than the mandates that Rome had made it. From their side, the Waldenses came to feel more and more that no teaching except Christ's was binding. The scriptures must rule. But how could they find support for their cause if everyone lived in apostolic poverty? Slowly, they came to accept, just as early monastic houses had, two levels of Christian commitment. The main members of the movement were bound by special vows and worshiped together in simple services, while a circle of friends remained in the main Catholic Church, but supplied new recruits and financial support for the movement. Even after their excommunication, the Waldenses gained so many members, the church launched an all-out assault on them, encouraging some of the Crusades to begin in Europe by practicing the skills that they needed to use on the Muslims by slaughtering the Waldenses. The Waldenses were so clearly a back to the Bible movement that over the years, some have called them reformers before the Reformation. Compared to the Roman Church's doctrine of papal authority, the Waldensian call to return to the Bible does indeed sound like Luther or Calvin, but their view of salvation, a life of penance and poverty, it lacks the clear note of God's grace that sounded so powerfully in the Reformation. I just mentioned that the Roman Church's doctrine of papal authority, that's an expression of what's called the doctrine of apostolic succession, a subject of huge controversy between Roman Catholicism and Protestantism. I recently posted a video on apostolic succession on the Into His Image YouTube channel that you may be interested in watching. You'll be able to find a link to it in the description below.